Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Welcome. Our guests are Libby Casey, joining us from Washington, D.C., Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News. The Tucson shooting set off a national debate on the tone of the national debate. Libby, describe the reaction in Washington, what you've heard, which has essentially brought the Congress to a halt this week.
Well, there was absolute sadness, of course, at first, and concern and horror. And the Alaska delegation all reacted with press releases, at least the two senators did initially. Don Young gave a statement later on, a few days afterwards, just expressing outrage, shock, and horror. I think it was too close to home to people. Many people, of course, know Congressman Gabby Giffords. They know her staff. And even people who don't know them personally, it was like it could have happened in my town. It could have happened in my district. Members of Congress go out to their districts all the time and bring their hardworking staffers with them. And, of course, staffers were also the victims of the shooting. The thing that started to happen then, of course, as the day went on Saturday, was the Twitter sphere. The internet exploded with speculation about why this could have happened, how it could have happened. There were some erroneous calls initially on about the attack. But then it was interesting to watch how that conversation evolved and how Twitter and the internet did become ways that people could share messages, could actually get news out quickly once the accuracy had been verified. The dominant theme this week has been safety, how members of Congress can make sure they themselves and their staff are safe, whether here in the Capitol or back home. And then this issue of civility in the dialogue. And I don't think anyone in among the folks I've talked to here blames the negativity of dialogue, certainly at least among the Alaska delegation, for the tragedy. People are not directly linking the alleged shooter in Tucson with the national dialogue, but they're saying, here's an opportunity to raise the standard. Here's an opportunity to step up and take some responsibility and just get the dialogue healthier and a lot more maybe articulate and less negative.
Okay. Libby, let's stay with you. You're thinking about security in Congress on Capitol Hill. There are already more police officers there of, I don't know, 5-8 different types of police forces than any place in the world. So isn't the real question what happens out in the districts?
Yeah, the Capitol Police Force is very strong. Interestingly, Congressman Don Young says there's too much security in the Capitol. He'd like to bring a gun into the Capitol. He'd like to see less of this checkpoint mentality. He says after 9/11, there was too much put into place when it comes to security. But otherwise, and Don Young is talking about how he's going to keep carrying a firearm when he's back at home in the District of Alaska. He's definitely planning to, in his words, if anybody shoots at me, I'll make sure I take them down as well. So he's kind of taking this more rootin' tootin' attitude and talking about how he believes that more guns will actually make Americans safer. The senators are talking in terms of how to make sure their protocol is up to snuff. Don Young says he's been here for, you know, nearly 40 years. He's pretty comfortable with his security protocol. The senators are just going through a checklist and making sure that when their staffers do go home and do make trips around the state, that they will feel safe and that everyone knows how to identify unsafe problems. The senators pointed out a lot of people in Alaska may think that they have an entourage of safety, security teams. They may have an armed patrol or something, and they don't. When Ted Stevens, the late Senator Ted Stevens, was Senate pro tem, which is the highest rank in the Senate, third in line to the presidency, he had a security situation, but otherwise they don't.
Okay. Steve McDonald, yeah. What do we know about threats to Alaskan political leaders here in Alaska, and for that matter, threats to reporters, journalists, editors, and others who gather the news and are public figures?
Well, I haven't heard anything at all where any of our leaders have been threatened with violence or anything. I haven't heard anything like that at all. To refer back to what Libby had said, I can remember going into a news conference here in Anchorage held by the late Senator Ted Stevens when he was Senate pro tem, and noticeably different. He really traveled with no security that I ever saw, but when you walked into the room this time around, it was noticeable.
On the other hand, most of us know, at least by name and by sight, Bob Cockerell, who traveled with many governors.
Oh, yeah. Who's been the personal bodyguard of, boy, I don't know, how he goes back a long, long way.
Sheffield, I think, at least.
And we do know Bob real well. He's a common sight.
Most unquotable man in Alaska.
Yeah.
Never get anything.
Just great fella. But we know, you know, you talked about editors and reporters. We know about the Ramsey case years ago down at the Anchorage Times building when he stormed the...
Stormed the cab driver.
Right. Stormed the building and fired off some shots and the Atwoods.
And a staffer was shot at the Anchorage Daily News.
Yeah.
And many people forget that.
That's true too.
Somebody worked in the printing part of it, but by a former coworker.
Right. So that does happen here as well.
And people get letters. Governors get letters. Journalists get letters.
Mm-hmm.
I get letters. Somebody was going to horsewhip me.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We've all gotten that. And maybe you just don't pay them too much. Of your attention, give it too much of your attention. But then, after something like this in Tucson, maybe people will.
Jill, any reflections on this before we go back to Libby and ask her about the inevitable question, what about Sarah Palin?
You know, just regarding, I guess it's the culture in which journalists may be operating. You know, there are times when you're at an event or perhaps in a criminal courtroom where things might get a little tense and you feel that level of intensity and you feel that level of anger. I personally have never experienced a situation in person where I felt like my safety was threatened. But the level of anger that people might be putting forward, whether in a political discourse or some other situation, is sometimes a little uncomfortable. Like you don't quite know. You definitely understand. Anything, yeah, just the sorts of things that can make people very, very angry, and certainly if they don't want to have their situation disclosed, it can further anger them or perhaps family members. That's pretty rare. I mean, I think the most intense situations that I've encountered have been in the political spectrum with people who are deeply impassioned about their beliefs, who deeply believe the other side may be wrong, and who are very forceful in communicating their point of view. Now, I don't know that level of anger you can, you know, correlate to violence, but it certainly can sometimes be a little uncomfortable.
I hate to be negative in this, but I just don't see this event that happened in Tucson. You're talking about the tenor of the national debate. Is it going to change? Is it going to take a more positive tone and get out of the gutter that it sometimes falls into? After 9/11, people were saying the exact same thing, and that obviously was a national disaster, maybe perhaps even an international disaster. That attack on the World Trade Center, and a lot of people for a while flew the flag and showed a lot of patriotism, and politicians pledged to have a better discourse about issues, and it seemed to galvanize the country. Now we're back into the same situation where we're in, you know, the national discourse has taken a real negative turn, and it has become quite, in some ways, violent in terms of the words that are being used. I hope it changes. I really do. We need it for the good of the country, but I don't know if this event's going to change anything.
The Christian Science Monitor has an article out that addresses this and talks about civility. How do you build it? And even if you were to build it, is there really a home for it within the current political setup? Because in opposition, in vitriol, is an opportunity to not only gain the spotlight, but also to have power and leverage that power. And so how do you set the bar in terms of which speech is acceptable and which speech isn't and what's designated over the top?
Yeah. And a lot of what happens is left to the individual judgment of individual people,
some of
whom don't have good judgment. Let's get Libby Casey in here. And Sarah Palin was at the center of this story. It surprised me that she wound up at the center of the story. But Libby, what's been the reaction to Sarah Palin's comments, video comments?
Well, of course, initially Sarah Palin reacted in a post on Facebook that was expressing more of a heartfelt sympathy for the victims of the Tucson shooting. But why her name got pulled into the dialogue is because her PAC, Sarah PAC, was responsible for creating this map last year during the healthcare debate that had sight targets, like rifle targets, crosshairs, on different districts. Not on people's heads or anything like that, but on the districts. And at the time, she was saying things like, you know, don't retreat, reload, and there was a lot of gun imagery used. Certainly, she was not the only one doing that, but that map got a lot of heat this past week. And Sarah Palin put out a video, about a 7-minute video remark on the day that President Obama spoke. That was on Wednesday. She did it that morning. And what's being talked about in Washington is the contrast between Sarah Palin's address and President Obama's address. And whereas President Obama is being lauded right now by people both on the right and on the left as sort of trying to take a moment to be the healer in chief, speaking more in terms of a unifying moment, talking not so much about politics and more about the victims of the attack. Sarah Palin went on the defensive, and she, in this sort of fireside chat moment, used her time in the spotlight to take people to task for really putting the focus back on her. And, you know, it's interesting to see the reaction. People who support Sarah Palin right now, she was speaking to her base. They are still more solidified. I talked to one conservative media watchdog, a commentator today, who said, hey, she had to defend herself because she is being put squarely in the middle of this and she doesn't deserve to be. But others said, boy, it's too bad that she didn't use this opportunity to rise above the fray and not just listen to the attackers, but just listen to the greater dialogue of, like, how do you rise above this conversation and how do you elevate the discussion? Yeah, when I talked to the Alaska delegation senators, Senator Begich and Senator Murkowski, they didn't blame Sarah Palin's map at all for destroying the national discussion or taking things down a notch. They said, hey, we're all part of this. But what Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich both said is, as a parent, I really think carefully about the words I teach my children. And Lisa Murkowski doesn't have young kids. She has, you know, teenage, nearly grown sons. But she said being a parent made her really conscious of the use of language. And so she's making a conscious effort to be aware of her language and be aware of how the fact that she's a leader, she's someone who's in the political landscape, she contributes to the dialogue. And Mark Begich said, hey, I don't blame Sarah Palin, but I wouldn't have used those words. I would not say, don't retreat, reload. And I would not have used that map because okay. I want to bring this to a better place.
We need to move on. Steve, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline closes down for a few days. This comes as quite a surprise. Yeah. It's one of the longest closures of the pipeline.
Yeah,
where are we now and what can we expect?
Oh, let's see. Well, it went down 850 last Saturday morning when a leak was detected at pump station 1. It seems, according to Alyeska, it's all been contained inside this this concrete building and no environmental damage has occurred at this particular point in time. Right now, they're trying to fit 9 different pieces of pipe together that they've constructed in Fairbanks. They've taken it up or will take it up to the North Slope here soon, and they'll construct a bypass around this pipe. This where this leak has occurred. This is not the main 800-mile-long, 48-inch-in-diameter pipeline. This is a 24-inch-in-diameter pipeline, and so it's a much smaller line. So right now, at last report that I heard, it was running at 50%. They're going to turn it off again here, I think, to make
these prepares. This is on Friday at noon.
It's Friday at noon, yeah. So it had been running at 50% capacity, and they are going to take it down again to make these repairs and then hopefully crank it back up. But they're really concerned about this. Obviously, the cold weather can freeze things. They're still, when the oil comes up out of the ground, it's mixed with gas, it's mixed with water. It goes into these gathering centers where all the stuff is jettisoned off, but they still have a little bit of liquid, a little bit of water in this oil. And they're very much afraid of this freezing up and damaging the pumps as this oil goes through, and then they're of course afraid of the paraffin that builds up on the inside of the pipeline. So you just don't hit like a auto start to turn this thing on.
Let's get Libby back in here briefly. Libby, has the leak/closure on the North Slope received any attention in Washington, or has it just been swamped by other issues?
Yeah, it's certainly being watched by financial markets. The EPA has stepped in, the Environmental Protection Agency, and my colleague up in Fairbanks, Dan Bross, has been reporting on this, and Steve Heimel in Anchorage have noted that Democratic Representative Ed Markey has actually sent a letter to Alyeska asking some questions about why Pump Station 1 sprang a leak. But otherwise, it's not really on the minds of people down here because everything is so focused on Tucson, the health care bill, the repeal vote next week. That's pretty much the focus.
Okay, let's go back to Jill Burke. Jill, you recently had a story in the Dispatch about a surprising development, the rise of Native Hawaiian corporations that are in many ways reminiscent of Alaska corporations. Please tell us more.
Yeah, they are starting down the same road that Alaska Native corporations have gone down, which is figuring out how are they going to generate money, how are they going to benefit their people, and striving for business opportunities, and namely government contracting opportunities to achieve that. A newspaper in Hawaii recently reported that some of the players that had been familiar in the Alaska Native Corporation world are now the same players who are involved in the Native Hawaiian organizations down there, some of them anyway. Some of them are nonprofits which have for-profit subsidiaries that are landing these contracts to engage in construction, and then, like Alaska Native Corporations, provide benefits to their shareholders. But the reporter who was profiling these and saying, look, here's a relatively new phenomena, and these corporations are also enjoying some explosive growth in the sense of gaining access to these construction opportunities, among other things, are hard to track. We're not really sure if they're doing what they're supposed to do. And this individual was a little bit frustrated.
And so, these corporations, to the extent that they're formed and up and running, are being created in the context of criticism.
Yes, they are. The Alaska Native corporations are certainly under scrutiny, have been for a while because of their high level of success. You know, who's getting the money, how it's being spent, and if it's being spent wisely is a matter of concern for taxpayers. And at least one member of Congress has made it a point to take a look at what she perceives as egregious waste, fraud, and abuse and put an end to that. And so the Native Hawaiian corporations are kind of coming up underneath that culture. And you know, Alaska Native corporations have had some 20-odd years to get the situation figured out and to learn it and to make it work to their advantage, with some great successes and admittedly some failures. Native Hawaiian organizations maybe have been at this about 5 years. They were kind of a late addition to the privileges that Alaska Natives and Native Americans enjoy.
They are fortunate in that they have two very senior Democrats, Dan Inouye and Mr. Akaka, Senator Akaka, who are behind them.
Right, and Inouye, a very good friend of the late Senator Ted Stevens. Both of them together shared a commitment to try to create these contracts with their particular state's indigenous people and give them opportunities for economic development. And so this is very much patterned along Alaska Native corporations, but it remains to be seen. You know, they say we have a right to do this. Let us exercise our privileges and do what we will. And at the same time, people are wondering if that's fair.
Okay. The Dispatch also had a story on another Native issue, important Native issue, and that is Native teachers and the creation of more Native teachers from especially rural Alaska.
Right. Go ahead. Oh, we took a look at this because the Department of Education recently awarded, I think it's about $1.1 million to the University of Arizona to facilitate getting current educational paraprofessionals who are involved in the school system, get them to get their bachelor's degree, and go on and get a teaching certificate and stay in the classroom from the Navajo Nation. And there, the statistics say that for some 80,000 Native American Alaska Native students, there are only 1,000 Native teachers. And within the Navajo Nation, the student population is like 60,000 in the public school system. And they really believe, ASU, the School of Education, believes that, you know, quality education is a basic human right, and that in order to adequately teach to the Native population, they need to have teachers and mentors who share their similar cultural backgrounds, similar traits, who understand where they're coming from, and who are from their home community, and who have staying power there. So their program's really interesting. They're going to start doing distance classes, and people in their home communities will be able to attend ASU by way of real live video uplink, so they'll see and hear each other. They'll be attending classes at ASU, but they could be in some far-flung community.
This is pretty wonderful,
isn't it? Yeah, it's a big deal. So Alaska has similar issues, getting, increasing its number of Alaska Native teachers among its public education workforce. And there are greater barriers here, according to the people I spoke with, than exist in Arizona. A lot of our communities aren't on the road system. A lot of our communities aren't dialed in technologically to be able to even support a kind of real-time video feed. So there are programs that exist that are also Department of Education grantees that are striving to do this. But even after years and years of working, the percentage of Native teachers to non-Native teachers is right around 5.5% and that's not as high as people would like it to be. They also think No Child Left Behind is a huge barrier, that the things that make teachers passionate about what they're doing, kind of the art of teaching, and for students the love of learning, which oftentimes means incorporating local traditions, culture, heritage, whatever it is that gets a teacher and a learner motivated, is lost to the rigid academic tests that have to have. Yeah, the teachers spend all their time trying to get the kids ready for these academic tests and the rest of the stuff that they think might matter. There's no room for it in that equation. So still work to be done. Successes have been made.
Thank you very
ongoing
much.
Ongoing issue, yeah.
Let's go back to Libby. Libby, the Oil Spill Commission issued its report on the Gulf blowout this week. And there was some material in there on, at least by implication, on the future of oil and gas development in the Alaska Arctic. Tell us about it.
That's right. One of the commissioners is Fran Ulmer, former lieutenant governor, now at the University of Alaska Anchorage. And so she did bring an Arctic perspective, an Alaskan perspective, to the panel. The report made no bones about squarely placing blame for the BP blowout on BP, Halliburton, Transocean, but also on the government for failing to regulate. And the report talked about how this wasn't a one-time thing. This is a problem that's very widespread and needs to be dealt with. And it did address specifically the Arctic. It did not call for a moratorium or a halt to offshore drilling. But it was interesting to hear how people reacted. Like, I talked to Shell, which, of course, wants to do a test well this summer in the Beaufort Sea. And Shell was like, hey, no moratorium. We feel good about this. We're doing research. We're working towards this goal. Green light. Talk to the environmentalists who said, oh, no, no. If you read this report carefully, we believe that this pretty much says drilling shouldn't go forward because there are so many things that the report says are lacking in the Arctic. The report called for more research and development. It talked about how the science really isn't adequate when it comes to things like cleaning up oil spills in icy waters. Also pointed out that the Coast Guard needs a lot more funding, a lot more support. The closest Coast Guard base is 1,000 miles away from the Arctic. And so Fran Ulmer was very careful to say, as were the other commissioners, we're not calling for a moratorium or a ban. We realize the state of Alaska, the oil companies, the nation as a whole wants to see oil development, you know, proceed. And when I say the nation as a whole, what they're talking about is the nation needs oil, and that's a reality. But there are a lot of yellow lights here in the report. The question is, how will it be implemented? What will happen? Some things would require an act of Congress. Some things the Obama administration could move forward on more quickly. We're going to have to wait and see if this changes the permitting process for Shell, which is first out of the gate in its hopes to start work this summer.
Steve McDonald, any follow-on thoughts?
No, I think Libby summed it up real well. It's, you know, there's something in there for everybody and a different interpretation for all sides on this thing.
Okay, Steve, parking is back in the news. Yeah. Parking here in Anchorage.
Including a parking
The voters are going to be asked, who writes the tickets?
Yeah. Well, boy, this is a reincarnation of an earlier issue, isn't it? It's we used to have the Anchorage Parking Authority that wrote tickets downtown. The idea was to make sure that people weren't staying too long in the core part of the city and people were cycling out of there, and that would be better for businesses. The Parking Authority, some say, grew too big for its britches, all of a sudden started venturing into parking lots, giving people citations for expired tags, those kinds of things. And so people had a little bit of an uprising, and away went that organization.
I'm pretty sure they came to the Daily News. They probably came to Channel 2 as well.
Yeah,
right?
They did. Oh, yeah. I know they went into Kmart parking lots, shopping centers, malls, things like that. And people were saying, well, wait, aren't these guys supposed to be just downtown? So that went away. And now we have Anchorage police officers who are ticketing cars. And Anchorage Police Department is facing budget problems of its own, as is just about every governmental organization. So now people are saying, well, shouldn't police officers be doing more important work like going out and catching bad people? So now the proposals come before the assembly to create another sort of Anchorage Parking Authority, and that's what people are going to decide. And this time, they'll keep it in the core of the downtown.
Is there going to be a constituency of people who are going to push this?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, these things, sometimes people come up with these ideas and they throw it on the ballot and then it just dies on the vine because nobody does own it. Nobody does push for it. So I imagine that there will be some sort of a constituency. Perhaps the downtown folks may get together and maybe they'll talk about it and push it. But we'll see. There may be
Thanks,
some
Steve.
Bad memories out there, too.
Jill, here's news of importance to Alaskans. The NTSB wants to assure that not only do Alaskan aircraft and aircraft everywhere have emergency locator beacons, but that the beacons work. What does the NTSB have to say, and where do we go from here?
Well, this stems, of course, from the plane crash that killed late Senator Ted Stevens, on which a beacon was located. It was transmitting, but the signal wasn't able to be received because it had separated from its antenna and it had also separated from its mount. This is a problem if you need people to come find you in an emergency. And so they
sort of defeats the purpose.
It does defeat the purpose. It does, you know, if it, even if it's transmitting but it's broken apart, it doesn't do anybody any good. And so the NTSB is recommending that the FAA look at whether or not the current program regulating those is sufficient enough to ensure that they're installed correctly, and it wants to see some sort of action taken to make sure that these small planes have them mounted correctly. And I think, Steve, correct me here, that maybe on an annual basis, some type of review, but I'm not sure yet what the FAA's response is to the NTSB's safety
advisory. We're
going
to have to wait on that. Let's go very quickly. We have a minute left for Libby in Washington. Libby, Congress is getting organized. It always takes time. Tell us about committee assignments for Alaska's delegation.
Don Young's going to chair a subcommittee on Alaska Native and Native American issues. That's new. That's a bump up from him. He had a very low profile during the last Congress. He is, however, though, missing this weekend the Republican House retreat. He's just not going. So he's a player, but not entirely a player in this Congress. In the Senate, we'll wait to see how things evolve. committee assignments have not come out yet, but of course, we're all watching that, especially to make sure and see that Lisa Murkowski is able to retain her spot on the Energy Committee as the top Republican. That's something she ran on. We'll see if it happens.
Is Mark Begich apt to change committees?
We don't know yet. We'll wait and see. The thing they're really excited about is the fact that he has this leadership position among the Democrats now, which is significant. As a junior senator, only 2 years here, he's number five in the Democratic leadership.
Okay, we're number 10. We've got 10 seconds to get in and get out. Thank you for joining us. See you next week right here.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.